This episode of the Goop Podcast is brought to you by the House of Chanel.
Chanel introduces a new generation of sustainably developed skincare, infused with a high concentration of ingredients and derived from the uniquely revitalizing winter blooming red camellia flower. Packaged with lightweight glass, organic ink, and other bio-based materials, Numéro 1 de Chanel forges an unprecedented path of skincare innovation. Numéro 1 de Chanel, beauty ahead of time. To learn more about the line, visit chanel.com.
When you are pioneering anything or introducing new ideas to the culture,
you get criticized.
You do?
Yeah. Did you hear about that?
I didn't find the one. I found someone I respected and we made it the one.
In the sort of longing kind of view of love, people understand each other as if by magic.
Nothing in itself is addictive on the one hand. On the other hand, everything could be addictive if there's an emptiness in that person that needs to be filled.
I now know that nobody changes until they change their energy. And when you change your energy, you change your life.
I'm Gwyneth Paltrow. This is the Goop Podcast, bringing together thought leaders, culture changers, creatives, founders and CEOs, scientists, doctors, healers and seekers, here to start conversations. Because simply asking questions and listening has the power to change the way we see the world. Here we go. Today's guest is Katara McCarty. Katara is the founder of Exhale, an app focused on the mental wellness of Black women. In our conversation today, Katara shares her own personal story of being adopted into a Black family as a biracial child in 1970s Indiana, and how that upbringing rooted her in the values of community care. We talked about her journey from being a pastor for nearly two decades to deconstructing her faith and creating Exhale out of frustration at the lack of culturally relevant well-being resources available to Black women dealing with collective trauma. The app is beautifully done, and I ask Katara if she ever finds herself at odds between educating others about the frameworks that cause harm to Black women while also encouraging Black women, including herself, to slow down and rest. Her answer really made me think about the ways white women should be entering into conversation with Black women, how we hold space for them, and how we can fully center their experiences while acknowledging our own responsibility in dismantling these systems of oppression. So let's get to Katara McCarty.
I want to ask you about your toolbox, as it were. What I didn't realize when I was doing research, because I met you socially first.
At your house, no big deal. You're at your house.
Was that you're a pastor.
And I was. Yeah. Well, for 18 years. Yeah. How crazy.
Can you tell me about that?
Oh my God.
How did you tell me a little about how you fell into that and why you're no longer a pastor?
Oh, do you really want to talk about this?
I do.
Okay.
As long as you want to talk about it.
Yeah, no, it's fine. I didn't grow up in church. And so when I was in my 20s, I was kind of searching and feeling like I'd come out of a really traumatic relationship. It was an abusive relationship, toxic relationship. And so
like physically or
emotionally, it was starting to get physically abusive too. And so I was kind of searching for, like, you know, some peace or some something. And my sister was attending church and she was like, girl, you need some Jesus. Like you need to come to church. And I was like, oh, I don't know. I mean, we weren't raised in church, so it felt like, and I had observed some things that were toxic about the church environment. I was like, I don't want nothing to do with that. But anyway, I ventured in and had a spiritual experience. I still acknowledge that as a spiritual experience.
What happened? What was it?
I mean, I felt like the pastor was like literally speaking to me, like, I was like, do you know me? Like, it was like a whole group. It was his congregation. But when he was talking, I was like, have you been following me around? Like, how do you know this? Like, I just felt really compelled to, like, they had an altar call and I found myself in the altar. It was like a whole encounter. That was really beautiful. I still have fond memories of that time in my life. I was in my early 20s. I had just had my daughter, and it really grounded me. I think the biggest thing for me back then was community and having people kind of rally around me and love me where I was at. And it was a really beautiful experience. Then I met my husband. He was raised in church and was on a mission to like become a pastor and start his own church one day. And so he was so cool when I met him. I was like, you're like a church boy, but you're so cool. Like, you listen to like music I listen to, like R&B and rap. We fell in love, got married, and he was pursuing, you know, starting his own church. And I was just like, are you really? Like, I literally 2 years ago was backing it up in the club. Like, I have a baby. You know what I mean? I'm like, I don't think I'm pastor wife material. I mean, I'm not going to put my hair in a bun and play an organ. You know, I'm just not that girl. And he was like, no, like, I think that you could really add value and from your experiences. And so we embarked on launching our own thing. We did that in 2000. And I'm still really, really proud of what we built. My deal with him was like, okay, if we do this, it has to be a place that accepts all people, anybody, like the Qataris of the world that got pregnant at 19, had to drop out of college, was backing it up in the club 2 years ago. Like it has to be a place that is like inclusive. And he was like, absolutely. Like, that's what I want to build. And so we embarked on it. We started in our house with four people. They were family, all of my sister and his sister and her kids, and people came. And what we found is people that showed up were folks that were either unchurched, or we called them de-churched. So people that were kind of fed up with the politics of church and the religious, the rules and the regulations. We were drawing to our house. And then we
saw more spiritual, like pure form of like the like Jesus's actual teachings.
Yes.
Like what he actually said, if you go back through.
Exactly. So we just loved everybody. We just loved everybody. We built something really beautiful. We started a school and church in Zambia, Africa. We were able to raise money and drill a borehole for a village there that didn't have clean running water. We started an after-school program for children in the neighborhood called the Center for Success. And kids would come, you know, back then they were like, these are at-risk children. And I was like, well, I just think these children just need a place to go. They just need a place to go after school. And so we would help them. I created it. We set it up like I set up my house. So we would give them a snack when they got there, which is what I did with my kids. We would sit down and help them with their homework. Their grades started getting better. So we were a community church. We really were about outreach, like reaching beyond the four walls. We drew people that, you know, wouldn't fit into a traditional religious setting. So back in 2000, people were freaking out because we were like, gay people were coming to our church, and the religious community in the city was just all up in arms. Like, oh my gosh, what are you guys doing? What are you doing over there? We're like, we're just loving people. So had a really beautiful experience. We had a beautiful staff. It was amazing. And then my husband had an opportunity to start working. He was bivocational for several years and started what's called the Culture of Good and within a company, this organization and company, and just was doing a lot of good. We used to do backpack giveaways through our church, and he was able to do backpack giveaways that were like 60,000, 100,000 backpacks instead of just 1,000 backpacks through our church.
Wow. So
we kind of like he saw the writing on the wall. It took me a little bit longer to see the writing on the wall that he could make greater impact being a part of creating his own company. And so we transitioned out of pastoring, not because anything went wrong or anything was bad. We just felt like he could do more good taking that route. When we transitioned out, it started happening before we left the church. I started having what I call a deconstruction of my faith. Mm-hmm. And so I don't adhere to Christianity. I don't adhere to any form of religion. I am a spiritual person, but I don't practice any particular religion.
Did you feel that it was confining or judgmental, or it just something devolved naturally? Like what happened?
Yeah, I felt like it was what we had created at God's, it was called God's house. What we had created was, I didn't see that in other places. And so while it was really beautiful and wonderful, that wasn't the norm. And so I felt like I didn't want to be a part of an overall religion that left, you know, it wasn't inclusive. Wasn't inclusive, is actually oppressive of women. And I don't, and again, like I don't have any, I'm not trying to say anything bad about it. I just personally can't be a part of an institution that, you know, that doesn't accept all people and love all people. And so for me, it was about my values not aligning anymore with the overall religion, right? Like the overall values of Christianity. So I just decided to, like, I don't want to be a part of that anymore, you know?
So when you were young, you grew up biracial. White father?
No.
White mother?
White mother, black father.
Black father. But you ended up, didn't you say you ended up kind of being raised more in a black house?
Yeah. So I was born in 1972 here in Indiana.
Twinsies.
We gonna be 52 this year. Yeah, I was born in 1972 in 1969 in the state of Indiana. It was still illegal, or it just like the law changed in 1969 here. Before then, it was illegal to marry outside your race.
Wow.
In 1969. So I was born in 1972. So my white mother got pregnant by a black man and her family.
How'd that go down?
They were like, it's a big no for us. Like you can't bring, I mean, they said to her, I now know because I've met my biological family. You can't bring a black baby home. Like you just can't. And their family, once the small town here in Indiana found out she was pregnant by a black man, they just harassed her, her sisters, their family. She was getting a lot of pressure. And so when she went to the hospital, she had me and then she left me there. She just bounced. So I went into foster care, no named baby. Went into foster care and my file came across a woman's desk that had a niece who had already adopted one little baby girl and she wanted a sister for her or sibling. And so she called her and she's like, hey, we have this baby. We're having a hard time placing her because she is biracial. Her mom's white, dad's black. And my now mom, my mama, Betty, was like, bring that baby over here. I don't care. Like, bring her. And so I got delivered into the Waters family. I was just a few weeks old. And my mom is a black gay woman, so she was never married. And so in 1972, for a black single woman to adopt was just so progressive and so beyond the time.
Especially in Indiana, right?
I mean, in Indiana, yeah. And so her and my grandmother pulled their resources together to purchase a home and in a predominantly black neighborhood. So all my neighbors were black. All my friends were black. I grew up in a black neighborhood. I didn't know really the difference of like being biracial. Like
were you made aware of the fact that you were biracial?
Yeah. Like my mom was always really honest with us and told us we were adopted and what that meant. And that I was back then, she would say, you're mixed. And, you know, my grandmother would hot iron my mom's hair and my sister's hair and my uncle's hair. And I would be like, hot iron my hair. And she'd be like, sissy, you have that good hair. We can't hot iron your hair. You know, so there were like differences that I would notice, but I always felt so much love. My mom and grandmother, especially my grandmother, was just the most nurturing woman. She taught me about community care, how to show up for community. Growing up in the Black community, if somebody up the street is hurting, like you find out about it, you show up, right? And so she taught me about how to show up for your community. And yeah, I grew up, I had such a beautiful childhood. My mom is such a badass. She's like, I always felt really safe. I'd be like riding my bike or out running the streets when I got a little bit older, and people be like, who's your mom? Who's your mom? Be like, Betty. And they'd be like, oh, don't nobody fuck with Betty. And I would always just be like, yeah, that's my mama. Don't nobody fuck with Betty. Don't nobody fuck with me. So I always felt really like safe and protected. And, you know, everybody knows everybody. And my mom still lives in the small town that I was raised in. I was just there on Monday visiting my grandmother's grave. And yeah, I think that my values and just the way I'm wired and who I am comes from growing up in that house in the Black community.
And did you have any, or how would you characterize your relationship to the white part of you? Was that in the forefront, in the background? Did you contemplate it? Did you not? Was it relevant, irrelevant?
Yeah, I mean, it was relevant because once I got to school, I remember being in the first grade and I'm sitting beside this little girl and we became friends, like fast friends the first day. She was a white, little white girl. And I remember going home and being so excited that I had met a new friend. And I went back the next day and sat beside her again. And she looked over at me and she said, my mom said that we can't be friends because you're Black. And so I just remember being like, well, that's odd. And it was like my first interaction with racism, like, wow. And then as I got older, it was like kids would find out that I was biracial and make fun of me and, you know, call me Oreo cookie or you're a zebra or things like that. And so it was present. But when I would go home, home was home. I could be fully seen and fully loved as a whole person in my home and in my community. But yeah, it was something that was present. It also, I was always really curious about my birth mother and my origin story and like, how did that come about? And I always kind of thought it was probably because of being biracial and that my dad was Black. And then years later, I did 23andMe and Ancestry and found my biological mother's family and my biological father's family and found out that that really was the story. And so I think there was a part of me that knew that already, though, that could feel that and sense that.
Mm. Yeah. So in the ensuing years, you're an author and you have a podcast and you're an acclaimed speaker, but you've really honed your work towards the wellness of Black women. You have an amazing app called Exhale, which is so good. It's a beautiful, it's so beautifully done. We've talked about this before, but of course, being a Black woman in America, and I don't know about the rest of the world, but I just know from my friends, you know, there are microaggressions or harm all day long. Let Black women experience, it could be micro or macro aggressions, but your hypothesis is that there are systems of oppression that exist, and then there are those interactions that come within those frameworks that cause harm to Black women. And Exhale is this beautiful app that centers Black women's mental wellness and really physiological too, right? Like the meditations, et cetera. So how did this become your focus, like the empowerment around self-care, and how are they linked?
Yeah. Yeah, I never intended to launch an app. It was never on like my like vision board or my goals. One day I'm going to have an app or a tech company. In 2020, we were all really troubled by the state of the world and the pandemic. All of us were told to stay home. And so with my job, I could stay home. Some people couldn't. And so I was really stressed and worried. And then the news started reporting that the pandemic, COVID, was impacting the Black community disproportionately. Mm-hmm. I have an elderly Black mother. My sister is a social worker. She was still going into people's homes when I was home and other people were, we were told to stay home. So I was really, really worried and stressed about my community. And I was also really frustrated because the news wasn't reporting the full story. They were just saying the Black community has pre-existing conditions and that's why they're getting COVID. And I'm like screaming at the TV. I'm like, we have pre-existing conditions because of systemic racism and health disparities. And blah. So I was just really frustrated around that. And then the killing of Ahmaud happened and it played out in our news feeds. The news cycle, watching him basically getting hunted down was just so traumatizing for all of us to watch, but specifically for the Black community. And then Breonna Taylor, George Floyd, others. And I mean, what I was feeling along with the Black community, that level of stress, anxiety, trauma. And I know that we all knew, right, that this oppression exists in our community. It's not like Black men don't get shot, right? Like this happens, it has happened, it's happening. But watching it, it was like it was being exasperated during that time. Mm-hmm. And so I could just feel the collective grief, the collective trauma, the collective anxiety. And I just started asking myself, like, well, what am I going to do? Like, what are we going to do? Like, I have to show up for my community in a meaningful way. And after we left pastoring the church, I became a certified coach. And so I was coaching people around their well-being and their life and mental health and their emotional well-being. And I just was so frustrated by what I was experiencing. And I was reaching for mainstream wellness apps, popular wellness, mental wellness apps to manage my own stress. And they were saying nothing. They were offering up nothing to the Black community during that time. Now they've been catching up. They've been playing catch up since, but during that time, they were not offering culturally relevant content. And so I remember thinking, well, there has to be, somebody's doing that. Somebody's providing resources for the Black community, specifically Black women, because of our own intersectionality and being Black and being a woman. And I'm like, surely there's something. So I go on a Google search looking and there's nothing. And I was like, how could there be nothing? And so I remember running upstairs, I was down in my basement, and I remember running upstairs and I told my husband, I'm like, oh my gosh, I think I have an idea. And he's like, we're in a global pandemic. You have an idea? And I'm like, yes, I have an idea. And so I told him, I really want to create an app that Black women can go to that speaks directly to the way in which they have to weave through life and how racism and misogyny weathers our mental health. It weathers our emotional well-being and impacts our physical health. And so, you know, I'm not an app developer. I didn't know how to do that. So we just started Googling, how do you bring an app to life? Like, how does this happen? And we launched our minimum viable product in August of 2020. I remember writing meditations on my front patio after I would go to a Black Lives Matter march. My husband and I would drive to Louisville, Kentucky to bring awareness around Breonna Taylor's, her being killed. And we would go do that. And I would come back and sit on my patio and write another meditation. And then I would go in my closet and record the meditations. We're real fancy over here. We're real fancy over here. And, you know, I just saw a need and I saw a gap and I wanted something. And I started asking my family members and my friends, Black women in my life, like, would you use something like this? What do you think? And they would be like, oh my gosh, yes, yes. And so I got the idea and we made it happen. And it came out of frustration, but more so it came out of a place of rage. Mm-hmm. Rage that there wasn't a space for us to exhale, to breathe. I really believe there's power in our breath. And just like George Floyd, that knee was on his neck and he kept saying he couldn't breathe. I was like, if we could just take a breath, as a community. Yeah, that's how XL came to life.
So what is it specifically like? How did you think about creating content or meditation specifically geared towards Black women? Like, how would somebody interfacing with it know that it was designed for a Black woman?
Well, first of all, when you open the app, you're going to see representation. So we have Black women in the app, models, our photos, and also our meditations and breathwork techniques are really designed to speak to us. So for instance, we have a meditation that talks about microaggressions, right? So instead of, you know, ignoring that we face these every day, we have a meditation that talks about that and how to decrease our stress in those moments. We have a meditation called Our Ancestors, where we do a guided meditation to connect to our heritage, right? Like our people. And so it's not just about having, you know, seeing myself, but it's about hearing myself. It's about hearing about my experiences and that it's that they're valid and that there's a way to decrease the stress that comes from these systems of oppression that impact us negatively. I think it was in 2020 that the CDC declared racism as a public health threat for the first time. The medical community acknowledged that. That was a huge acknowledgement and a huge awareness, right? We know it's happening, but for them to declare that is really significant and powerful. And so we need specific tools, specific resources that speak directly to that, that it's harming us, right? Instead of something general, we're more specific with our resources.
What are some of these existing like tropes, if you will, around Black women in our society as it exists today? You did an amazing survey that I read. Mm-hmm. Was it last year? Did you do it or two? Mm-hmm.
Last year. Yeah.
Called The State of Self-Care for Black Women, a really in-depth survey. And I was surprised by a lot of, yeah, I guess surprised and not surprised, but it was just sort of stunning to see it all the data aggregated in one place. Cause it's, I think it's like particularly brilliant that when you set out to do this app, you know, you had a vision for it. And then as all founders do, right, as you progress, it seems to me, just looking at you from the outside, that you wanted to sort of have a depth of data behind why the app was necessary and tailor the app more and more to the need that exists and why. So has a survey like this ever been done before?
No. It's the first of its kind. Which,
so tell me how you did, like, what was the impetus to do it?
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to hear from Black women. We were pulling some resources together to build a new version of the app so that we could launch we launched it last year, but we had gotten a grant and got a tiny bit of funding. And so I wanted to know and hear from the women that I was creating this for. And so it started off as like market research, right? Like, let's ask what do they want? Would they pay for something like this? How much would they pay? What are they? And then it's as we started developing the questions in partnership with one of my Highland sisters, shout out to Stella from New York. She is a physician there. Beautiful Black woman, amazing, phenomenal, smart. We started forming the questions and with her partnership and this analytics firm, we realized that we could do a more robust, full report on the state of self-care for Black women. And so we broke it into asking 1,005 Black women about their mental health, but also about their emotional well-being and their physical health. So it's like a 30-page report. You can go to our website, xl-app.com, and download it and read through it. But we wanted to hear from Black women. We wanted to know, like, I know how I feel. I know how my girlfriends feel. I know how my mama feels and auntie and them feel. But like, I want to hear from a larger group, right? And so we
was it a surveyed demographic? Was it like over age, working, non-working? Was it a mix?
It was a mix. Okay. So it was different socioeconomic statuses, working, not working, mothers, not mothers, heterosexual, not right. Right. It was not heterosexual. Right. We wanted like a robust mix. And so we set out to do it and we got some amazing data, really confirmed that I was on the right track around creating Exhale and that there was a need in the market. Black women said, yeah, we want this. 77% of the Black women surveyed said that they want more well-being tools and resources catered to support their specific needs. And so, yeah, the data really informed how we built the new version of Exhale as well. And so we held some panel discussions. We were able to take the data on the road and have some really beautiful events where we got to have conversations and Black women came up to me afterwards and said, oh my gosh, I'm not alone. There are other women that feel this way. There are other women that are being impacted and it feels good to hear about it, right? So yeah, it's a beautiful report. I hope folks go and download it and read it. Something that, you know, I wanted to do once we realized, oh, this is a full report, is to also have non-people of color read the report and then ask the question, like, how am I showing up for Black women and women of color in my life, knowing this information now that, yes, they have everyday stressors, but they also have the stress that comes from racism and systems of oppression. And so how can I then show up for Black women in my organization and in the institutions that I'm a part of and in my corporation, in my business, in my neighborhood, in my community, right? And so it's a calling in too for non-people of color to say, here's the data. This is what they're saying. And how are you showing up?
Yeah. And wonderful to offer an academic context. You know, it's just like data like that, I think really does serve to put a net underneath you psychologically when you know what, you don't feel alone and you do feel, you know, like one data point I thought was super interesting that was like 36% of Black women have left their jobs because they didn't feel safe being a Black woman in their job.
Yeah.
I thought that was stunning how high that percentage was. So what's important then for those of us who aren't Black, who aren't people of color, who are in companies, like what was some of the data around that specific stat? What do managers need to do tactically to create a really diverse or inclusive workplace?
Yeah, I think that we all have a lot of work to do. 3% of Black women that we surveyed said that they don't believe their current work environment provides supportive resources for them, specifically because of the intersectionality that they hold, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think that what we can do, what leaders can do is, well, first of all, they can call me and get Exhale app for all the Black women and women of color within their organization, right? And their company.
Yep.
And also really think about how they're approaching their leadership through an anti-racist, I was going to say lens, but it really is a practice, an anti-racist practice.
Yes,
and instead of like kind of putting everybody in a bucket and treating everybody quote unquote the same, right? Like being colorblind, I think it's really important for us to see color and for us to recognize that Black women and women of color in your organization is carrying or being impacted by systemic racism. Right? That there's all kinds of things that come with that, right? And if you know that, then how are you providing resources or care, right? For instance, when George Floyd's killing was flooding our news feed and on our phones, maybe going up to Black people in your organization and say, you know what, you just take the rest of the week off. Just go take the rest of the week off. Go rest. I'm sure this is traumatic for you, right? Even though it's not their family, right? It is impacting them, right? Yeah, right. It's impacting the community. And so being aware of what's happening and understanding how it may be impacting, you're not going to feel it. And so it is about being diligent and being intentional and paying attention to what's happening in the world and also what's happening in, you know, your employees' lives, right? And yeah, being sensitive to that. And that takes a lot of work, because when you're weaving through life not in a Black body, you wouldn't know, right? It's like, but you have to know. Right. It's your, especially if you're leading people, especially if you're in a leadership position, you have to know. You don't personally know. You won't personally feel it, but it is up to you to do your due diligence to learn and to understand and to become a better leader. It makes you a better leader too. Right. Like, yeah.
Absolutely. So the other day, I work closely with a Black woman, very senior Black woman. And we were having a discussion around this trope that's in your report around this sort of strong Black woman that is so, so deeply endemic to the culture. And this idea that, you know, I see it in the Black women in my life that they feel they have to achieve, you know, 100% more in order to get the same respect. I can make suppositions around why that exists, going back probably 400 years. Mm-hmm. How do we encourage the Black women in our lives to slow down, to breathe, to give themselves grace, to be allowed to fail? Like, how do we encourage that?
That's tough. That's a tough one. Yeah. Yeah, it's a trope, man. It's mm-hmm. it's just like you said, it goes back so far. It's so deep. It's so ingrained into our society that we can manage more pain, that we can manage more stress, that we can manage to more the point work.
Where Black women, like the maternal
health
rate, yeah, right?
In absolutely. Providers don't always believe Black women, right? So
yeah, that's very well established.
Yeah. So it runs deep. So it's really hard as a Black woman then to pull away from that and say, I don't have to be strong. You know what I mean? Like if everybody's expecting that of me, if everybody's assuming that of me, then how do I show up differently? If I show up differently, that may not be safe for me. If I show up soft, quote unquote, softer, that may not, or more vulnerable, or not with my armor on, that may not be a safe space for me. And so I think it's up to, again, non-people of color to create spaces and places that give us that encouragement. Right. You know, yeah, people are like, oh, you should be able to show up at work, you know, fully as your full self. And it's not always safe for us to show up as our full selves mm-hmm. as Black women in spaces and places. And so, you know, what I've, you know, tried to do in my own life is to practice, to be in, put myself in community with other Black women where I can rest, where I can pull back and not have to be the strongest person in the room. Mm-hmm. And that has, for me personally, has been really healing. I love Trisha Hersey, the NAP ministry. I love her work and telling us to rest and take a nap. I encourage you, if you're listening and you're a Black woman, get her book, read her book, follow her, take a nap, put your feet up. You know, and I also look to like my mom and my grandmother. I remember I would be just running around and coming inside and in the house, and my grandmother would be in her chair with her eyes closed, and my sister and I would think she was asleep. And so we'd start cutting up, acting up, doing stuff we weren't supposed to. And she would say, "I'm not asleep. I hear you." And I would say, "I thought you were napping." And she would say, "I'm just resting my eyes." And I'm like, now as an adult, I'm like, oh, how powerful is that? Like, she was practicing not being strong. She was practicing rest. She was practicing ease. And I have thought about that in my adult life, like, oh, maybe I just need to pause and close my eyes if I'm in a safe environment, a safe space, and just rest my eyes, that there's something really powerful in that. And so my encouragement to Black women is to find those spaces and places that you feel safe in, where you can take off that armor, where you can say, I don't have to be strong here, right? And start doing that as a practice, right?
Yes.
And then hopefully the rest of the world will catch up and create environments where we actually are safe.
Mm. Beautiful. Do you, is it sort of counterintuitive that, like, you talk about Black women finding the space to rest and to create that space internally where that's prioritized, and yet you're trying to educate people all the time on, like, how to center Black women's wellness? How do you do that? Like, I mean, it is sort of a little bit at odds with itself, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm not trying to educate people to center.
When you speak, or you're not.
No, I mean, I used to try.
You don't have to kind of get in the mix.
I used to try to, like, convince people. And then, you know, I was like, you know what? My work is not to dismantle these systems. My work is to not convince non-people of color to do that. That's not my work. There are other people and educators and lots, especially Black women. I encourage people to follow Black women that are teaching anti-racism, that are doing that work. Follow Monique Melton, take her classes, all her classes. But that's not my work. And I learned that pretty early on as I was embarking on this, that my commitment is to Black women. Mm-hmm. And when I say women, that is inclusive of my trans sisters, my gay, right, sisters, right? Like, it's inclusive that when I say women, Black women, that word women is inclusive. So
anyone who identifies.
Yes. And so I decided, okay, my work is to connect Black women to resources to help manage the impact of these systems. And how do we build community and take care of each other? Again, I grew up in a Black community. I grew up in a house full of Black women. It was me, my grandmother, my mom, my sister. Like, we nurture each other and care for each other and love each other in beautiful, amazing ways. And I've learned that, and I've experienced that. I've been a recipient of that. And it feels like full circle for me. It feels like this work is like coming home. Like, these Black women that took me in as a baby with no name, now I get to provide care for Black women. And so my work is to say, Black women, let's prioritize ourselves. Let's center ourselves. Let's take care of ourselves. These systems are wearing us out. They're hurting us. They're harming us. They're killing us. We have to return to our breath. We have to prioritize ourselves and our mental and emotional and physical well-being, because racism's out in these streets, y'all. And so we have to prioritize ourselves. So that's my work. Now, the report was to say, hey, if anybody wants, you could, it's free to download, it's free to read. It's information for you, if you're not Black, to take it and learn and grow and figure out ways to engage other educators to become better, right? To create safe spaces, brave spaces. And so that's not my work. I ain't trying to convince nobody. I'm like, listen, I'm over here prioritizing Black women every day, all day. I'm prioritizing myself, and I want other people to do the same, but I'm not trying to convince people to do it.
So when we were at my house and we all kind of went around the room, your daughter was there. Both of your daughters were there. One of your daughters said, that she was there to listen and hold space for her Black mother, which was really interesting. It was so sweet. It brought a tear to my eye. She was acknowledging that her experience is different to your experience. Mm-hmm. And it was so beautiful to see that almost like that your child, your own child, could see her mother so deeply, even in a way where she maybe couldn't fully identify, mm-hmm. but holding space for you as a Black woman. And it really made me think, as a white woman, what are the ways that we should be entering into conversation with Black women? Like, what your daughter said was really powerful and really shifted my perspective. Mm-hmm. Is that something that should be acknowledged, like, by a white woman to a Black woman?
Yeah, I think that holding space takes acknowledging the fullness of the person you're holding space for, right?
And acknowledging that their experience is so different. You know, we live in this wildly patriarchal mm-hmm. society that has lots of white supremacy woven all the way through it that we're not even conscious of, right? A lot of the time. So right. What is our responsibility in terms of, like, articulating that we're calling that out, you know?
Yeah. I think it's really acknowledging again that the intersectionality and the misogynoir that Black women have to, I don't think I ever say that word right. I'm always like, misogynoir. But how sexism and racism manifest in Black women's lives, right? And having that, like, acknowledging that that's true, first of all, mm-hmm. and entering into spaces and places, relationship with Black women, and acknowledging that that's true. You don't have to necessarily verbally acknowledge it, but just acknowledging it. Mm-hmm. And if you're doing exactly. any kind of work to dismantle your own biases, right, and to dismantle racism in your own life, holding space means listening. It means considering that the Black woman that you may be in relationship is dealing with way, way, way more stress than you, regardless of her position or economic status, yeah. right? The fact that her skin is, that she is Black and she is having a different experience than you. That's not, and I just want to be clear, it's different, right? But I just want to be clear that word different means she's experiencing harm. She's experiencing hurt, right? She's experiencing trauma from these systems, systemic racism. And so it's not just, oh, your life's different than mine, right? Like, we have differences. It's like, okay, yes, but those right. differences mean hurt, harm, trauma, sometimes death for us, right? And so entering in with an understanding, not from a personal, like, I know exactly how, you know, not from like, I have a lived experience, but I've educated myself enough to know you're facing and going through things that I will never go through. And how can I hold space for you? And you could even ask that. Right. You could even say that if you're in relationship with Black women. If you have friends, like, how can I hold space for you today? Mm-hmm. Like, how can I hold space for you? How can I show up for you? Right? How can I be an ally? That. How can I be an accomplice with you? Right?
As my friend Ella says, yeah.
Co-conspirator. Yeah. How can I do that? And listen to Black women. Listen, listen, listen. The wisdom, the depth that comes from Black women, like, listen. Right? Don't talk as much, right? Like, go into, like, holding space. Like, you watched my daughter hold space. She didn't say much,
no.
right? She didn't say much, but she was there and I felt her support and I knew she was there. And I know she knows enough. She's educated herself enough that if somebody said something off, and I didn't feel safe to respond, I could look at her and she would, right? It's that too. It's standing in front of, right? It's like, I have your back, but I'm actually going to stand in between you and this nonsense that's happening, in between you and this harm that's happening. And I'm going to put my white body, right, in between you and the harm. So, yeah.
It's amazing to see. Katara, thank you so much. This has been such a lovely conversation.
So good. Thank you for having me. Thank you so much for that. That was like, that's holding space.
Thanks for listening to my conversation with Katara McCarty. For more from Katara, you can tune into her podcast, Ready to Exhale, or download Exhale, the app. This has been a presentation of Cadence 13 Studios. I hope you'll listen, follow, rate, and review all of our episodes, which are available for free on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Odyssey, or wherever you get your podcasts.